Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution of the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Welcome to the Capital Connection. I'm David Gustina, sitting in for Alan Chartok again this week, an honor to do so. And our guest is Jimmy Vielkind, who covers New York State government and politics for the Albany Times Union and his, of course, Capital Confidential blog that many of us who follow politics want to make sure we're reading on a regular basis. And Jimmy, welcome back to the program.
Oh, it's a pleasure, David.
Real great pleasure to be speaking with you face-to-face. You and I have talked over the phone and on the air, but have never been face-to-face with one another, so it's good to see you in front of me. And why don't we start with this, and that is, in the grand scheme of Albany politics, you and probably me as well are fairly new to the scene in relative terms, you even more so than I. But as a reporter who's, you know, down in the trenches, down in Albany, mining your sources, trying to get that news out to your readers, tell us a little bit about what that's like. Now, I know that you're from the region, so you've probably been paying attention to New York State politics and government for a long, long time, but give us a sense of what it's like as a reporter who covers the New York State Capitol.
Well, it's, you know, it's just an incredibly dynamic environment at the Capitol for journalists, for people who are interested in politics, Republicans, Democrats, people who are involved in issues or who care about issues and want to get involved. And I think that's what drew me, like so many other people, both from this immediate Capitol region. I grew up in Clifton Park, a suburb about 30 miles north of Albany. Actually, I don't know if it's that far any miles. It's about 30 minutes drive north of Albany, depending on the traffic. That drew me to the Capitol. And, you know, it's just an incredible privilege, and it's an incredibly interesting time, I think, to be here. We have a governor, Andrew Cuomo, a Democrat, who is becoming rapidly more and more of a national level political figure, and who I suspect over time may become a serious national level political figure, perhaps even a contender for the presidential nomination in 2016. Certainly, that's something that most people in Albany do have one long eye on. We have a state that seems to be at a tipping point in many, many different ways fiscally. You know, we're kind of the old part of the country. We're the part of the country that really had seen its peak, and as other parts of the country like the Sun Belt and areas of the Southeast and the Southwest have really boomed and grown over the past few decades, New York had been relatively stagnant economically. And it's interesting to watch state officials really work to jumpstart that and change things over. Here in the Capital Region, of course, we are seeing an economic boom related to nanotechnology and high-tech construction. So it's, again, interesting to see how that plays out and
the
how
so-called public-private partnership.
Exactly. And underlying all of that is this idea of what should government be in the 21st century? And especially after, and I started as a reporter at the Capitol in 2008, actually the day before Election Day, I started reporting for the New York Observer. And, you know, that people should, if anyone listening ever gets offered a job as a political reporter starting the day before a major election, there's a two-word response that they should give the person, and the second word is off. So,
Well, I can agree with you only in that, as a broadcaster, the day after the results, that's the worst day for me, because there's so many races, and especially this time around when there were so many crucial Senate races here in the state of New York, when we're trying to figure out who's going to be in the majority party, was a particularly tough election season. But please continue.
Well, and so it's just been very interesting to see the contrast in what was a relatively short period of time between the tenure of David Paterson as governor, which came shortly after the tenure of Eliot Spitzer, which was itself a fairly short tenure in office, certainly shorter than I think everyone expected, to see Governor Cuomo and to see his team move in and to see how they are acting and how they have assumed the mantle of governmental leadership. And as you just alluded to, David, of course, there's this question about the control of the state Senate. Now, I mentioned that day in 2008, the day of the election. I was in Buffalo. And the day after the election, I can remember very vividly driving back to Albany and getting to the Capitol and looking to see Senator Malcolm Smith, who it seemed was going to be the Senate Majority Leader. And Democrats had retaken control of the state Senate for the first time since 1968. And really substantively for longer than that. They were only in power very briefly in the 60s, the Democrats. And to see, what would that be like? What would one-party rule be like in the state that has not experienced it for its modern history? It didn't last very long. And it's just so interesting to be here in 2012, exactly 4 years later, essentially repeating the same story in many ways, in that Democrats in these last legislative elections finished ahead in four seats around the state, which should be enough by numbers to give them a 33-vote majority in a chamber that is being upsized from 62 to 63 seats. However, there are problems within that 33-person block that have prevented it from becoming a working majority. And so control of the Senate chamber remains unclear. We're talking before Thanksgiving. I think this broadcast is going to air after Thanksgiving. And as of now, we do not have clear winners in two state Senate races in the Hudson Valley.
41st and the 46th.
That's right. The 41st, where incumbent Republican Steve Saland has apparently lost to Democrat Terry Gibson. Saland was hurt during that general election by a challenge from Conservative Party candidate Neil DiCarlo.
Right, which split things.
Precisely, and gave Gibson the ability to win, it seems, narrowly with less than 50% of the overall vote. And in the 46th district, this is a newly created district which stretches from Montgomery County in Amsterdam through the hill towns of Albany County, through Greene County to Ulster County, and encompasses much of the areas, including Kingston in the northern half of the county.
Often these very strangely drawn districts that stretch into different and weird shapes.
And I think the last time I was with your listeners, we were talking about that.
That's
and the process by which those districts were drawn. But in this race, the Democratic candidate, Cecilia Kacik, was of a very low profile until very near the end of the election cycle when two downstate super PACs decided to pledge to spend $500,000 on advertisements boosting her. And that put her ahead of Assemblyman George Amador, a Republican from Rotterdam, who might be familiar to many people who don't follow politics, as the head of the Amador Home Building Company, which was featured in
ABC show where they build homes for
Extreme Makeover.
Yes.
Clearly, David and I aren't watching the show.
We're not. I'm not up to watch these shows. But So Amador, the Republican, is
who had what seemed to be more of a public profile in this district, and frankly, who had the district custom fit for him by Republicans who controlled the redistricting process this spring. He finished on election night 139 votes behind Kacik.
And it's seesawed a couple of times since,
back and forth as we're talking today. Amador is in the lead, but it's possible that a winner will be declared next week. It's also possible that there will be legal challenges to some of these absentee and affidavit ballots that will decide the outcome of this election, that this could be tied up in court and the result might not even be known by January.
Now enter Brooklyn Democrat Simca Felder.
That's right. All right, so let's take a step back and let's do some math, right? So the Democrats, I said that they have an apparent 33-vote majority.
Right.
So let's strip that away a little bit. So that includes four victories where the Democrats picked up Republican-held seats or an open seat. So there's Kacik, and for purposes of this discussion, we'll count her as a victor for now. Also Gibson, with the same caveat. So Kacik and Gibson have picked off two Republican seats. In the Rochester area, Ted O'Brien bested Assemblyman Sean Hanna for a seat that had been held by Republican Senator Jim Alesi.
That was a pretty big win, too, wasn't it?
It was a fairly big win, and it was a win that, toward the end, it seemed comfortable for Democrats. I think that the Republicans, at the very last minute, might have realized the winds were against them and allocated their resources elsewhere. But the fourth win was in South Brooklyn, in a new district known around the capital as the Super Jewish District, meaning that it was drawn to contain a majority of Orthodox Jewish voters, a community that typically votes very homogeneously and that often votes to support more conservative candidates, be they Democrats or Republicans.
Right.
And in this case, I believe that community really went heavily for Mitt Romney over Barack Obama, largely over foreign policy and their posture toward Israel. So, we're at 33 minus 4. That's 29 Democrats. we need to subtract four again, because the 29 Democrats really includes the four-member independent Democratic Conference.
Now, what's this all about? Explain to listeners what this IDC is and what it means.
They might be familiar with this because it's actually not something that's new. The IDC was formed in January 2011 after Democrats were driven from the chamber majority by the Republicans. And this four-person renegade clatch, led, if not by title, then in fact by Bronx Senator Jeff Klein, mm-hmm. they essentially seceded from the Democratic Conference. They started sitting with themselves. They were treated fairly well by the majority Republicans. They gave them resources. They gave its members some chairs over some committees. And they, in return, but not in return, I think that's too strong a causal way to put things, they, after that, would back the Republicans on a few key votes and a few key moments. They helped the Republicans along without at any point really stopping to argue for progressive Democratic principles on several issues, including support for same-sex marriage, including support for a fund that would provide scholarship money for undocumented immigrants, and including an increase in the state's minimum wage, which is something that all four of these members increase, but that support that the Republicans do not support. But this four-person block seceded, in effect, because it was not happy with the leadership of the mainstream Democratic Conference, which is currently led by John Sampson of Brooklyn, whose own tenure and his own control is questioned and something worth watching in its own right. So when we do that math, we get down to actually having 25 Democrats. And so if you were to add in the four winners, you get to 29. And if you were to subtract Felder, because as you said, David, Felder has announced that he will caucus with the Republicans, thereby effectively giving the Democrats only 28 seats. So if the Democrats, for the Democrats to actually get that working majority, which would be 32 votes, they would have to sustain their wins in the Gibson and the Kotchick race, which I don't think can be predicted. We have to open
Absolutely
the ballots
not.
And see what's going to happen. I think that there's a decent chance of that. I don't think it's an unreasonable possibility. And then they would have to reconcile with that independent Democratic Conference, and then they would get to 32 votes. Republicans have an easier path. If they
yes,
are victorious in the Kotchick-Amador recount, and again, there's a reasonable chance that they will be, then they, with Mr. Felder's support, will be at a 32-vote majority. IDC can do whenever it wants. But as an insurance policy, or perhaps as a parallel strategy, the Republicans have been courting the IDC. Leaders have reportedly met with Klein.
Well, let's stop there for a second, because we know that leader Skelos in the Senate met with Simca Felder
mm-hmm.
immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever he said to him, whatever might have been offered, right, he agreed to caucus with the Republicans.
Well, you're right. And so it raises this question. And Felder had said all through the election cycle that he would caucus with whoever would best enable him to serve his constituents, which, if you wanted to take a crass view of it, means that he was for sale to the highest bidder.
So let's take a crass view of it a second, Jimmy Bielkind, because I do. And this is what it is. When you get down to it, okay, we understand what you're saying. A majority, even if the Democrats win here, isn't necessarily a majority. But the way they go about making that majority, is that democracy?
Well, yeah. I
it
mean,
is?
In the sense that it's a democratic system. So it's unclear what, if anything, was promised to Mr. Felder. Of course, Mr. Felder says nothing, and the Republicans say nothing was promised. I wouldn't be surprised to see Mr. Felder as the chairman of a committee of his liking. Of course, in the state Senate, the numbers are such that most every majority senator gets to chair a committee. And I think he might do pretty well in the office lottery if it ever came down to that. And also, I think that Mr. Felder, as I said, he represents this unique constituency, a predominantly Orthodox Jewish district, that has issues before it. One which is very important is the idea of the treatment of parochial yeshivas, of Jewish
right.
schools, and how they are treated with terms of in terms of taxes, in terms of aid that goes to non-public schools, in terms of what rights parents have, who pays for busing, etc. So, you know, maybe the GOP, maybe they'll look favorably upon some of these issues, recognizing that They're important to Mr. Felder because they're important to Mr. Felder's constituents. And frankly, even me in my most crass can say that that kind of is democracy, right? You do the best for the people who elected you, and they say, give them hell. We sent you to Albany to get some for us, and you did. And so in Mr. Felder's case, it seems that that meant leaving himself open to conference with the majority caucus. Now, what you brought up was what some of the mainstream Democratic allies and senators are saying, which is, all right, look, folks, the state of New York is now 2-1 Democratic just by enrollment. If you look at enrollment, Barack Obama won with 63% of the vote here. So he won a fairly clear victory. New York has not elected a Republican to the governor's mansion in 10 years, a Republican to statewide office in any regard, for that matter, in the last 10 years. Polls show that a majority of New Yorkers want to see a Democratic state Senate. And if you take the aggregate vote totals around the state, a majority of New Yorkers voted for Democrats to run the state Senate. And let's take a fourth step back. If you look at the majority of districts, assuming Ms. Kotchick and Mr. Gibson win, Democrats will have won a majority of those districts. How on earth, given all those facts, can the GOP maintain control of the state Senate majority?
And this is where I come down, and I think it's a little different than you characterized, and that is when you have a legislature that is a bunch of oligarchs, that are people that have more power than everybody else, and they can punish you, they can take your committee away, they can give you a committee, they can knight you, they can do all sorts of things to you to bring you in line. And that's why we talk about the lack of power in a minority house. So to me, that's not democracy. That's the rules of the legislature that they make to keep their leaderships in power, and they use it in a way that isn't democratic. And now you've got a Democrat who's caucusing with the Republicans when on many issues they may not agree philosophically, but he's doing it for a crass reason because I'm going to get something for my constituents. Now, right, that's bargaining, and to me that's not, that's almost, dare I say the B word, bribery in a way. So that how's that democracy?
Well, I don't know if it's my place to really rebut that or defend it.
No, you don't have to. That's just my own personal statement there. By the way, forgive me for this, but I put that out there on either side of the political aisle. I have no favorites here. I mean this on both sides.
Absolutely. And of course, Dave would be the first to admit that the Democrats control the Assembly.
Absolutely.
Have for many, many, many years.
And I'll do the same tactics.
And essentially, right, essentially employ the same tactics. So the state of play at the Capitol is that the leaders of each legislative majority do have immense control over the operations of the House. And so what does that mean? What does that mean for you if you're a citizen? You probably hear a political reporter like me write something like that, and you think, well, who cares? I don't care who gets money for staff. I just don't care. Where the real power lies is in controlling the flow of legislation. In Albany, bills don't fail once they come to the floor. I think that maybe a dozen bills, I'm being generous, in the past 10 years have actually come to the floor vote and failed. So if there's an issue that's important to you, which House controls the majority has the power to bring that legislation to the floor and, of course, because it has the majority, theoretically, to pass that legislation.
Right.
So it'll be very interesting to see how this plays out in the state Senate, and particularly to see if it does become a bidding war for Mr. Klein and the Independent Democratic Conference, what the IDC demands. Now, Mr. Klein is being very, keeping his cards close to the vest. He's not shared publicly, at least as of this recording. He has not shared what he desires, and he has not shared his negotiating strategy. And this makes basic sense when you think about political negotiations. What if he were to stand up for reform? What if he were to say, I will caucus with you, Senator Skelos, or with you, Senator Democrat, be it Sampson, be it Michael Gennaris, the Queens Democrat who chaired the conference's political operations. I will conference with you, but I want us to redo the Senate rules. I don't think that the majority leader should have such absolute control of the flow of legislation. I think that there should be a rule where if you have the signatures of a majority of senators, be they any party, then you can advance the bill to the floor. Or I think that a committee chairman should get the opportunity to advance three bills per session to the floor. That's a rule. Or I think every senator gets two trump cards. They can pick any two bills they want, send it up for a full vote of the Senate. And if the Senate passes it, okay. If it fails, okay. It still has to go through the Assembly. that would be an interesting remaking of the state government.
Sure.
That would create a dynamic that I think would be more open than we've a process than we've seen in Albany in recent years. But this is it's unclear whether this is actually going to become anything close to reality or remain the dream of government reformers.
And my doubts. We're talking with Jimmy Vielkind, who covers New York State government and politics, of course, for the Albany Times Union. But Jimmy, we've had two converging events. We've been talking about these elections, and the leadership is in flux in the state Senate in New York. Then we had this prospect of a coming special session, and we were going to solve some problems, including one that was maybe not on the top of the minds of the public, but certainly on the legislators, which is a legislative pay raise. The other major event is Hurricane Sandy, which has thrown everything in disarray, including the state budget itself, rumored to be now another $1 billion in the red. So, you know, there's these two converging events, and now we're hearing probably no special session and no decisions on some of these issues because the leadership's in flux, and this comes from the governor.
Right. The governor said earlier this week that the Senate leadership question, as well as the fact that the governor himself is preoccupied with the response to Superstorm Sandy, which is focused in downstate areas, on Long Island and in the five boroughs of New York City, particularly low-lying areas of Queens, Staten Island, but also Westchester County and Rockland County and some of the northern suburban areas in Lower Hudson Valley, that this has essentially distracted the governor's attention and that he will not have time, he said on a different radio outlet, to call a special session to negotiate substantively with state lawmakers and come up with an agenda that could be passed. So
we're kind of waiting now.
We're kind of waiting. And I think that this next year's legislative session, if you think about it, if you were to just ask a political scientist who doesn't know anything about the dynamics of Albany, they would tell you that it would be a tough year for the governor. A new governor comes in the first year. He or she has a very big mandate. That's their big point, right? They can swoop in. They can get things done. They command a bully pulpit. They theoretically have high standing in the public, according to opinion polls. They're getting the benefit of the doubt from outside observers of government, including journalists like myself. And that is their time for major achievement.
Sure.
And if you look at Cuomo in 2011, his first year in office, he was able to push through a tax cap. He was able to legalize same-sex marriage. He balanced the budget on time, something that had not been done for 10 years. He revolutionized the way that the Medicaid budget, this kind of third rail of New York budgeting, was dealt with. So he recognized this.
And so did the people.
Right, and so did the people. So the governor did that. 2012, second year, okay, you need leverage. You need a leverage point. And so the governor realized that redistricting, this process by which once a decade, based on new census data, legislative district lines are drawn. The governor realized he had leverage around this, and he essentially traded it for a reduction in pension benefits for newly hired public workers, as well as arguably some of that same-sex marriage and the support he got from Republicans, and as well as a deal that restructured income taxes.
But why else might the governor have made a deal on redistricting?
Well, there are some people.
What's the speculation there?
There are some people who suggest that he wanted to see the Republicans stay in power because he saw when Democrats ran the state Senate for 2 years. They did so, as the governor himself said, dysfunctionally. And Democrats, of course, dispute this. But I think that the governor realized that there was steadiness. Chaos is not Cuomonian. And there was steadiness to the ship that served him and served his larger narrative of getting things done, working across party lines.
So does it also give him someone to blame?
It could, when he needs one. But so I think the question for this coming legislative session had been, what will dominate the agenda? And then as a result, what leverage does the governor had? That pay raise was leverage. And now that we've seen the devastating effects of this storm, we've seen preliminarily that it will double the state budget deficit to $2 billion.
And probably more.
I think we've seen quite clearly what will dominate the political discourse in this state for months to come. And I think that that will start shaking out over the coming weeks, and it will be playing out over the coming months, perhaps the coming 2 years.
We've been speaking with Jimmy Vielkind, the reporter who covers New York State government and politics for the Albany Times Union. And of course, you can get to his Capital Confidential blog from timesunion.com, and where you can sign up for the AM Roundup now. It's a new newsletter that they're putting out. Jimmy, thanks so much for joining us on the Capital Connection.
My pleasure.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. Ian Pickus is producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign. Online at nyscasa.org.